You started your career as an economic historian.
I did.
Fairly mainstream.
Very much so.
Yeah. But you became a bit more critical over time of the methodology and the rhetoric.
I did.
So, in your opinion, what, if anything, do contemporary economists mostly get right, and what do they usually get wrong? And did the classics know better than today's?
Well, they get right efficiency. The things that Nuno was talking about, they get right that opportunity cost needs to be considered and you should do cost-benefit studies and things like that. But what they get wrong is the longer-term history of the world. Most particularly, the tremendously important role of liberty in innovation. I mean, if a person in business is forbidden to introduce Uber, as is the case in Germany and France, they've made it illegal, then it's not, the economy is not in that respect going to progress if you stick with regulated taxes. So so that there's not enough of that kind of thinking of how important ideas are. Because economists tend to be, both on the left and the right, tend to be materialists.
So do you think the so-called neoliberalism is a strawman concept, and otherwise do you distinguish your liberalism?
Well, it's certainly a strawman. I have friends on the left, and I have a friend who just wrote a book on neoliberalism, and it's kind of a swear word on the left of these terrible people, Margaret Thatcher and so forth. And what they're not seeing is that the core of liberalism is just allowing adults to be free. That doesn't mean they can do anything they want. I can shake my hand around, but if I hit you in the nose, or the state or someone should stop me from blowing COVID-19 up your nose, and so forth. So and then sort of on the other side, my friends on the left think that there's kind of a free lunch to be had. That if we just give subsidies to everyone, everyone will be better off. It's the Argentinian model. And it's kind of, I was once a Marxist. I understand the attraction of free lunches. Hey, who wouldn't? But they're not. And in a way, liberalism is adultism. Let's all be adults and recognize that if we're going to have government expenditures, someone's got to be taxed, and it can't just be that person. It ends up being this person. So let's watch it.
That's quite reminiscent also of James McCallum.
Yeah, that's right.
So in that sense, and to that end, how important do you think free market think tanks like ours in this case are in promoting a liberal society? And what about liberal political parties?
Well, so far as the think tanks is concerned, I am now I hold the Isaiah Berlin Chair in Liberal Thought at the Cato Institute in Washington. So I'm showing by my very behavior that I'm in favor of liberal think tanks. But I'm in favor of socialist think tanks, too. I'm in favor of thought. If people are serious, they should have their own little think tank and think. But it is terribly important that this voice be heard. Because we tend to have the conservatives on the one hand and the socialists on the other. And the thing is that liberals are neither. They're not on this spectrum from left to right. They're kind of floating above up here. Because what the spectrum is about is how to use the massive powers of the state. Should they be used in a conservative way or in a left-wing way? And we liberals don't like power. Power tends to corrupt. So getting that message across, and you know what strikes me over and over again is that my friends on the left and a lot on the right are startled, are surprised when I make a very old-fashioned liberal argument for something. I don't know. Let's take public schools. I say I should be taxed. Deirdre should be taxed to pay for public schools. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the state should be run like the post office as a state enterprise. We should be paying for elementary education. But and people say, oh, my God, oh, that's terrible. Oh, they haven't ever thought of it. And that's the role of these think tanks.
Do you relate that with the work of Elinor Ostrom?
Yeah, I do. I'm a big fan of hers. When she got the Nobel Prize, I said, wait a second, Ostrom. Ostrom, who's Ostrom? Is she another game theorist? And I said, no, wait a second, that's Elinor Ostrom. She says, as a woman would, that maybe we can talk this out. That's her essential insight, that maybe we don't have always a prisoner's dilemma. Maybe we don't always have a kind of football game guy hating each other. Maybe we can talk about it and solve social problems that way, ground up.
Again, the topic of conversation.
Conversation, which is something that young women start very early. I had the disadvantage, I was a guy.
going back to our discussion with Nuno, in your opinion, for economic development, what is the role of the importance of formal education or schooling as compared to culture and ethics?
I don't think formal education has much to do with it. There's actually a good deal of evidence on this point. English, specifically English, not Scottish, but English elementary education in the early 19th century was quite bad by comparison with, say, Prussia or the United States. Yet England grew very fast. Look, what you need for economic growth is the husband being allowed to go to work in a factory, the wife being allowed to sell fruit in the market, entrepreneurial ideas of people to be implemented.
Networking.
Networking, social cooperation, trust among small groups. That's what makes for economic growth. Here's one point that's often forgotten. Higher education is usually conservative. In Europe for many, many centuries, universities were devoted to the conventional truth in theology, law, and medicine, neither of which advanced very much, because until the coming of the University of Berlin in 1810, teaching and research were not connected. So it's not obvious to me that more education makes for a richer economy. Now, in another sense it does, and this is often kind of strangely forgotten. To become an educated person is a glorious thing and makes for a better life. To know about poetry and mathematics and, I don't know, astronomy makes you a fuller person, to learn about philosophy and so forth. So that it's not just occupational and economic that I'm talking about.
Yes.
But the economy is much more about letting people get rich and then they send their children to school.
Indirectly, when people go to school, they can also improve their rhetorical abilities, their networking abilities. So there's that indirect.
Yeah, but they can. But they often go to school to get government jobs. In most countries, that's what they have in mind. And that's the, you know, you're a insecure factory worker. You want your child to learn to read and to go to high school to get to be a postal inspector.
So this is an old one, but do you think Latin European populations are culturally less prone to capitalism than and the sort of the cold rules of the market? And I know you say that Max Weber himself at some point did not believe that anymore.
Well,
otherwise, how do we explain the sort of political and financial mismanagement that we witness in some?
Well, you know, because there are various statist theories that people have been very popular in France and its offshoots. In a lot of ways, Iberia and Italy, for that matter, are very much influenced by Paris. But I don't think that there's any entrepreneurial problem with Latinness, that you speak Italian. That people spoke Italian didn't prevent Florence, Venice, Genoa and so forth being great centers of trade and innovation. And indeed, an interesting fact about Southern Italians, who were unspeakably poor in their home in Calabria or Sicilia, they come to the United States or Britain or Australia, they're amazingly successful. So it's not because they speak Italian or eat spaghetti.
Or read Dante.
Or read nel mezzo del camin di nostra vita, mi ritrove per una selva scura, che la dritta via è smarrita.
I don't understand Italian.
It's the opening lines of the Inferno. Yeah. But anyway, there's nothing deep, I think, about Latin culture. Look, everyone said about China when I was a kid, and about India when I was a kid, when I was a young economist. Oh, they're hopeless. There's an Asian dilemma. Their culture prevents them from. And then in 1978, the Communist Party decided to adopt markets. Boom, up went the economy. Same thing happened after 1991 in India. So it's not deep. I think the deep argument is a mistake. The deep argument says you're fated because you're Portuguese. No, Palma talks this way a lot, and I want to try to help him get over that pessimism. Oh, you're Portuguese, there's no hope, which is ridiculous. Modern Portugal is very rich by comparison with, I don't know, Somalia. So, or indeed, Portugal in 1800.
But culture still could still mean different cultures could still mean that the solution must be different for each country, in the sense that
maybe
for some countries they would be more likely to receive well some regulations and some institutions, and others they just try to move around.
Yeah, that's right. But there are universal motivators: profit, glory. That's a dangerous one, but profit, advancing your family, innovation, just the joy of doing new things, starting a new company, or thinking up some new thoughts. And those will work in any human population. Now, there are particular obstacles, I suppose. The opening line of Anna Karenina is that happy families are all the same. Unhappy families are unhappy in their own way. So I kind of agree with that. I understand what Tolstoy was saying, but I don't think there's a big look. Here's how to kind of summarize it. Liberalism works everywhere. It worked massively from the 18th century on. It's why modern economies are rich. It's not because of the state intervention. It's because letting people, much more than before, allowing them to have a go, as the British say. And then there are these spectacular modern cases of introducing liberal economics, alas, not always liberal politics, places like China and India, or Botswana, that works. Actually, a good example that people forget about is Ireland, which, although it was not completely poor the first time I visited it in the summer of 1966, it was quite poor. Now, of any moderately large country, it's the fifth most rich country in the world. Why is that? Not because of government policies, although education was somewhat helpful, and tax rates. Well, that's, but their tax rates are a liberal policy, low corporate tax rates.
Yeah, I was going to make you a question about that one, because I know you're not very in favor of arguing in terms of incentives and constraints.
I was trained in it. I'm an economist. Yeah. I've written entire books in favor of it. So it's not as if I reject it. Yeah. Incentives and constraints matter.
Yeah. My example was in Portugal, we see, at least nowadays, people are very fond of lotteries and sports bets and scratch cards.
And yeah,
it's a sort of almost a public health hazard, say. But it's much more likely that a young adult is going to spend time betting on sports games than trying to make a business. But as you said, the profit motive and the glory motive, it's always there. But
yeah, I know.
If you change the
that's right. A more important example than sports gambling, although I see what you mean. By the way, the biggest gamblers in the world are the Chinese, who are absolutely obsessed with gambling. So don't tell me that the Portuguese are peculiar in this respect. But a more important example is that you can get rich by stealing from people. So you can get rich by getting ingenious about stealing, or you can get rich by getting more clever at convincing the government to steal from them.
That's the Baumol argument.
That's the Baumol argument. And so what we need to do is block those ways.
Yeah.
There, your point about incentives is perfectly right. We've got to make sure we catch people who are trying to steal, certainly, outright stealing, so that people are moved into trying to invent stuff and innovate.
But perhaps your point, your further point is that to be able to do that, you always have to have the each culture in mind. So you can't just bring some institutions from the United States and expect them to work in Afghanistan.
Well, that's right, and we tried, and that failed, and in Iraq too. Yeah, that's right. Although, to go back to your earlier point, it is true that the unhappy countries are unhappy in their own way. In Afghanistan and in much of the Middle East, the problem is tribalism, which is a serious problem in any. It was a serious problem in England once, and then gradually disappeared, and we started being able to make deals with strangers. And that's, then you have to work on tribalism. Either make the tribes behave economically and somehow keep them from using their coercive or persuasive powers to prevent economic growth.
In a sense, that was the point of the famous essays by Frédéric Bastiat, and if you know that with the state you can make everybody else's life a hell, you're trying to... There's a tragedy of the commons. Or
there is.
So there everybody is. Tries if to be the first to get...
Well, in fact, that particular point's a very important one, because a big state that takes a big share of national income and has all kinds of regulatory powers is very tempting to corrupt. Because, boy, if you can get control of the United States government or the French government, your fortune is made.
Or of a strong regulator.
Exactly. So that's one argument, it's a quite general argument, about making states little. My own city of Chicago was the fastest growing city in the world in the late 19th century, the 1800s. Just a boom town, and was fantastically corrupt. Police were for sale, judges were for sale, politicians were for sale. And you think, well, how is that going to work? It worked because the government role was small anyway. So that it was corrupt, didn't matter.
Yeah, here in Portugal we have a great deal of discussions about corruption, the problem of corruption, but people tend to forget the point about the importance of the weight of the state. If the state is small, there's not much problem in corruption.
If there's corruption in this little part of the economy, don't worry.
Yeah. So it's a very important one for us. To what extent does the United States have a free market capitalism? And are Europeans mostly wrong when they characterize the U.S. economy as a free market economy?
Well, they're wrong. It's a mixed economy, and it varies somewhat from state to state in how much mixed it is, but it's a mixed economy. For example, people think that health care in the United States is entirely private and that poor people don't get any help, and that's wrong. I'm an example. Here I am, a liberal who wants a small government. I haven't paid anything for health care since I was 65 years old, because we have socialized medicine for old people and for very poor people and for certain kinds of handicapped people, socialized medicine. And so the contrast that people draw between, say, Sweden or Portugal, take two cases, and the United States is often greatly exaggerated because of the talk that Americans have. They say, oh yes, we're free. So you'll say, a farmer getting enormous subsidies from the federal government will say, well, I'm in favor of free markets, but don't touch my subsidy from the federal government.
Yes. So maybe as a last question, what would you say to a young Portuguese student or a recent graduate that is currently finding it very difficult even to leave his or her parents' house and is currently facing a very stagnant economic outlook? So how do we convince these young people to stay in the country and fight for a better future? I guess this is somewhat related to Albert Hirschman's Exit Voice and Loyalty.
Exit Voice and Loyalty, Hirschman was a brilliant economist and should have got the Nobel Prize for that alone and for all his other work. Well, look, I'm in favor of helping people not places. If Portugal decides to become a socialist paradise and ends up poor, and many people leave Portugal, well, okay. It's not the land that I want to subsidize or help or encourage, is a better way to put it. It's people. And if the best thing they can do is exit, they should exit. They should move to the United States or to England or something. But if they want to succeed in Portugal, look, if they want to succeed in a liberal way, they should start a business. They should get into business and do it well, and be entrepreneurs. There's still room in Portugal for entrepreneurship. And they'll have to fight against this very institution is a good example. I was told by the man who started it, who now has 46 branches of this all over the world, he told me that the educational bureaucracy in Portugal hates him because he's got a model of certain kinds of higher education where the students teach each other and work on projects, and that's their only guidance. So its expense is 20% what higher education usually costs. Well, so, but in any kind of business, you're going to be fighting against the forces of regulation and socialism, and don't do that, don't do this. But I think that, look, in the United States, we always say to our soldiers, thank you for your service. They get to go on the airplane first. They're in uniform. Well, look, anyone who starts a business, or for that matter, works in a business, they're giving service. We should be thanking everyone. In fact, frequently on the street, when I see someone sweeping the street, I go to them and thank them for their work. I should. We should be thanking each other all the time. But in any case, for young people, get educated, I think it's fair to say, but then go work in business and try to improve the well-being of other Portuguese people, or go work for a think tank and try to change their minds.
Voluntarily.
You can't put a gun to their head.
That's the ultimate way.
You can't do it that way. Yeah. That's what the Russians do.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
And you're very welcome. It's fun.